Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. For most of the 20th century, the social scientific study of religion has been dominated by secularization theory. This school of thought asserted that as societies modernized, the public role of religion would decline and private belief in the supernatural would wane. While this process would occur naturally through the spread of urbanization, the role differentiation and the advance of scientific knowledge, in some cases, secularization would be forced upon a population through a frontal ideological assault and direct government policy. This certainly was the case in the Soviet Union. Armed with the atheistic ideology of Marxism-Leninism, the ruling Communist Party of the USSR closed churches, regulated and harassed the clergy, and made life difficult for anyone publicly proclaiming belief in God. Although the intensity of the campaign to eradicate religion varied over time, the result of these efforts was to create a society where church attendance was virtually non-existent. Following the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, however, the spiritual marketplace was reopened and religious organizations were allowed to operate with less government interference than in the past. To discuss how the Soviet policy of aggressive atheism affected spiritual life in Russia, and more specifically the borderland regions of the former Soviet Union, I am joined today by Catherine Wanner, professor of history and anthropology at Penn State University. She is author of two monographs, Communities of the Converted, Ukrainians and Global Evangelism from Cornell University Press, and Burden of Dreams, History and Identity in Post-Soviet Ukraine, Penn State University Press. Welcome to Research on Religion, Kathy.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Today's podcast is going to be based on your Donald Treadgold Memorial Lecture that you are giving here at the University of Washington, the Jackson School of International Affairs. The title of that talk is The Future of Disbelief, Religion and Secularization in the Soviet Borderlands. And I want to press you a little bit on the title, The Future of Disbelief, because as we opened here talking about secularization theory being a dominant paradigm within social scientific studies of religion, it's taken some hits recently. Many people are backing away, including Peter Berger, who has backed away from the secularization thesis and saying that it's not inevitable and it might not even be probable in some cases. Most people would have today would title their paper The Future of Belief. Why did you choose to title your lecture and paper The Future of Disbelief?
Well, because after 74 years of sustained policies to promote secularization and even to promote disbelief, the results of that are quite palpable in the former Soviet Union, especially in the western regions of Russia and in the Baltics, in Belarus and in Ukraine. And it's that region in particular that I'm focusing on. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, of course, all of those efforts were entirely suspended. And you have entirely new laws and legislative policies concerning religion being put in place. And in some cases, they're specifically designed to de-secularize these societies. And I titled the talk The Future of Disbelief because I'm interested in tracing, after 74 years of trying to create disbelief, what are different states doing to create belief in some, or belief of a particular kind.
That's interesting. You talk about 74 years of trying to create disbelief. And before we talk about to what extent that was successful or not and what the residual impacts of that are today, let's go back. Let's step back. Roughly a century in history. Talk about 1917, you have the Bolshevik Revolution. What was the strategy behind and what were some of the tactics behind trying to eradicate religion? I mean, why was this a big deal to Lenin and Stalin to begin with?
Well, first, it's important to note how ambitious the plans the Bolsheviks had for entirely reforming Russian imperial society. I mean, this is an enormous country with an overwhelmingly peasant, illiterate population. And yet they're attempting to rapidly modernize, industrialize, and radically transform the society. And by extension, they also wanted to radically transform the consciousness of their citizens. So this is a very, very, very tall order. And it's also important to note in that society, religion was of the utmost importance. The Russian Orthodox Church, for example, handled a lot of very basic public administrative functions within the society, education, recording of deaths, I mean, so all census material. And in many of these rural outposts, really the church was the only form of, if you will, state representation. The Russian Orthodox Church was, of course, very, very closely allied with the monarchy. And given the sweeping redesign that the Bolsheviks had in mind, which, of course, included eliminating the monarchy, the Russian Orthodox Church was in many respects wrapped up in that. That is to say, along with these other aspects of Russian society that were seen as impediments to progress, the Russian Orthodox Church came under that rubric, and that's why it too came in for similar forms of sweeping reform.
Well, one point in your paper, you talk about how states oftentimes use religions to legitimate themselves through symbols and such. And this obviously, as you mentioned here, was the case between the monarchy and the Russian Orthodox Church. And so, you know, why couldn't Lenin come in and say, hey, you know, new regime here, let's go ahead and we want to borrow the Russian Orthodox Church and, you know, you guys are our partners now. Why wasn't that an option?
Well, it's important to note that initially, I mean, the kind of hostility that we know came to pass in the former Soviet Union towards religious institutions was not there from the start.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, Lenin, his main goal was to separate the functions of the church from those that the state should handle. Basic separation of church and state, which, let's say, in the United States, we would find entirely reasonable and acceptable. And as early as 1918, Lenin made that a priority. It was really under Stalin where things took a turn for the worse, for religious institutions. And it's also important to note that Stalin himself, at one point, was a seminarian. He trained to be a priest in the Georgian Orthodox Church. So he had a very keen understanding of the power of religion. And perhaps it's not surprising that he moved from that sphere into becoming a professional revolutionary, propagating a certain ideology.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about what Stalin does in terms of trying to eradicate religion. He's a seminarian. Actually, this is kind of interesting. I remember reading that he was a seminarian. Was there anything personally that tripped him up? I mean, why didn't he take that path of becoming a priest and instead becomes, you know, the guy responsible for crushing the Russian Orthodox Church? Was there something personal in his background? Was this he just absorbed Marxist ideology? Was this a political play on his part? He just loved power? What do you think is motivating him
here?
Well,
it's often said that the two greatest mistakes of the 20th century were not admitting Hitler to art school and kicking Stalin out of the seminary. He was asked to leave. He had become involved in revolutionary activity against the state, and that was seen as increasingly incompatible by those. His involvement was growing, and that was seen as incompatible with his training as a priest. And so he was asked to leave the seminary.
That's interesting. So it sounds like he was an early liberation theologian in the Russian Orthodox Church in many regards, and he just got booted from that. And I could imagine he was pretty bitter about that.
Yes, I think he was, and he was, of course, increasingly committed to Bolshevik ideology and to seeing a remake of Russian imperial society.
And so remaking Russian society, how does he go about do that? What does he do here?
Well, initially in the 1920s, it's important to note that the anti-religious policies were almost exclusively focused on the Russian Orthodox Church. on reigning in the church as a competing basis of power, as a competing magnet of the people's allegiance, which meant that for a variety of other minority faiths, this was very much seen as a golden period. For example, it was during the 1920s that the Baptists and Pentecostal and a whole variety of Catholic Church, a whole variety of others, religious groups had really quite a renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really during this period that efforts were nowhere near as intense as they would become to rein in a whole variety of minority faiths. And so they saw the 1920s as very much of a golden period.
That's interesting. And you're talking now. Let's give people a sense of the timeline here who might not be familiar with Russian or Soviet history. Lenin rules from 1917 to roughly when?
Well, he becomes ill. He's going to have two strokes. The first in 1922, but
right.
He is going to. So he his ability to govern already becomes compromised. Then he dies. Then in 1924, and without a clear indication as to who should take over. And it's at that time that soon thereafter, then Stalin really assumes the helm, and he becomes quite a pronounced and forceful leader with very, very specific ideas and policies. And it's really in 1929 that's called the period of the Great Break, when efforts to transform society, and these are the ones that are really going to affect religious institutions, become very sharp and very, very, very harsh.
So that's interesting to note here, because not only in terms of religious policy, we're talking earlier, Lenin was basically just trying to separate church and state, and as you mentioned, that it was really aimed at the Russian Orthodox Church. So it was an institutional affront against the Russian Orthodox Church rather than a widespread ideological assault on religion. And this seems to correspond, too, with in Russian history, the new economic policy where they were allowing, you know, profits to occur. So it was a kind of a pragmatic aspect to this. But and then Lenin falls ill. There's a power struggle. Who's going to take power? And then you talk about 1929 when Stalin comes in with the Great Break. I mean, he's right now in 1929, Stalin is probably the guy. He's the ruler now. Consolidated power. So what happens here in terms of religion policy?
This is when there's a real effort to close down religious institutions and to make registration of religious groups that much more difficult. And it becomes clear that the stakes rise for someone. Should someone choose to declare themselves a member of a particular religious institution, that information perhaps could be used against you.
How so? And what could happen if I said, oh, I really want to go to this Baptist church down the road? What are you going to do to me, Stalin?
Well, there were things that you could do to the actual believer, and there were things you could do to the believer's children. The things you could do to the believer would be to block their advancement professionally. By and large, people who were religiously active were limited to manual labor types of jobs. What you could do is then to their children is similarly to block their access to higher education. And these were very, very powerful incentives to get someone to not be a member, not
right.
practice the religion publicly. These were very, very pronounced costs that one would incur.
And this was true for all religions now, not just the Russian Orthodox Church, but Baptists, Pentecostals, Catholics, whoever may be there.
Yeah, there was variation into the degree in which they would go after believers of a different kind. I mean, I'm constantly amazed at just how flexible and pragmatic the Soviet state was. But in general, active belief of irrespective of faith group was discouraged.
Mm-hmm.
But they were far harder. They clamped down to a far greater degree on certain faiths versus others.
Mm-hmm. What other techniques did they use to try to eradicate religion from society, either institutionally or, you know, private belief?
Well, they also they used a whole variety of far more subtler tactics as well. Not just a lot has been written about the outright execution and imprisonment mm-hmm. of clergy and active believers, and all of that was very real. But they also used a variety of educational, if I could say, propaganda types mm-hmm. of techniques to try, specifically as concerns, let's say, agriculture and medicine, so as to try and cut in on people, someone who might turn to religion in the event of illness, or might turn to religion or, let's say, folk practices that involve the supernatural to affect agriculture. And they try to, via educational propaganda types of campaigns, to teach about fertilizers, pesticides, mm-hmm. or bacteria, immunizations, and the like, to try and use that as alternative ways of responding to uncertainty or the powerlessness that might come from illness or from capricious weather that would sabotage harvests.
Were there those propaganda posters put up?
Yes.
I love the Soviet propaganda posters. It's always great, kind of, you know, the Stakhanovite working guy kind of moving over to the, you know, let's all work really hard for the, you know, glory land of Mother Russia or something like that, which is...
You have to remember this was a heavily illiterate population, at least initially.
That's
so
true.
There was enormous reliance on this kind of visual imagery, mm-hmm. on pageantry, on processions. For example, they formed what was called the League of the Militant Godless, where they tried to create a group whose mission, if you will, was to propagate atheism. And they did this through various processions, through rural areas, and by staging debates and the like in more urban areas, so as to put forth an alternative worldview that was not going to include religion or appeals to the supernatural.
So they created their own church of atheism, in essence, with proselytizers and missionaries.
It was, if you will, an alternative belief system.
Wow.
That's right.
And so, I mean, was this a widespread effort? Was it just a couple guys going out and doing this? Or, you know, to me, it's kind of amazing to see a church of atheism. We don't think is going to be, you know, it's hard to propagate a disbelief in something, but you know, this is part of the propaganda effort.
Well, it was, in fact, not just a disbelief. They were trying to propagate education and mm-hmm. science. And they were trying to say that, and I think they genuinely believed that a good bit of religious belief and religious practice was born of ignorance and a feelings of powerlessness. And if they could propose something alternative that might, in fact, be based on science and, as a result, then might be more effective in responding to whatever was troubling a person, then that would, over time, yield a greater reliance on education and on science, which would then lead to greater progress and development and modernization of the society.
Mm-hmm. So basically, you know, trying to force ahead the idea of secularization theory through an organization, essentially.
Yes, I think they were trying to propose an alternative, if you
right.
will.
Okay. And so this is occurring mostly throughout the 1930s. What occurs in the late 1930s, early 1940s? And we've got something big going on in the world at that time, World War II. So does anything change here?
Yes. I mean, this is a really transformative decade for the Soviet Union. You have the policies of forced collectivization, where all peasant farmers are now forced to farm under an industrial model, if you will, and farm collectively. And there was enormous, enormous resistance to this. And this was largely seen as a catastrophically failed policy, but nonetheless one that was implemented and was implemented in such a way that there was no criticism of this policy allowed.
Right.
So you have then the forced collectivization, which led to a very, very punishing famine in Ukraine, where the estimates of the victims are usually somewhere between 6 and 7 million. You have another 5 million or so in Kazakhstan, where they forced nomadic herders into sedentary animal farms, if you will, like raising particular animals in a sedentary, once again, industrial model. And this was an entirely incompatible with the lifestyle and culture of the people there. And this led to also millions of deaths in Kazakhstan. So you have the failed policies of collectivization.
And that all these famines occurring mid-1930s?
Early 1932, okay. 1933 in particular. And coming on the heels of that, then you have what is known as the Great Terror in 1937-38, whereby the repressions radically accelerated. And in kind of a curious twist in history, they radically accelerated against the Communist Party elite in particular. It was high-level Communist Party officials as well as the rank and file that came in for repressions.
Mm-hmm.
Not just Communist Party members, but high-level military officials, members of the intelligentsia, right on down.
Stalin's purges.
Right.
Right.
The purges. And so going into the war, it's important to note that the decade that they had just lived through was particularly punishing.
Mm-hmm. And what, in terms of religious policy, what is going on here and what changes in the 40s?
Well, repressions against religious believers and clergy carry on unabated.
Right.
I mean, there's no relaxation of that whatsoever in the 1930s. Things in yet another ironic twist of Soviet history, it's, if you will, the war that saved the church. When war broke out, of course, Stalin quickly realized that he needed to mobilize his citizenship to fight and civilians to sacrifice. How do you do that? And so he radically changed his policies towards religion. And so beginning in 1941, you have a rescinding of a whole variety of measures that were taken to repress religious institutions and religious believers. I mentioned earlier the League of the Militant Godless. This was rendered entirely ineffective and eventually disbanded. He allowed then for the Patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church to be appointed once again. And he made other concessions to your average believer, like allowing Easter and Christmas to be once again holidays. They had been taken away from the official calendar and rendered a day like any other. So these were a whole variety of concessions that Stalin made to religion and religious believers, and this worked. In other words, religious life really overnight rebounded to a remarkable extent.
What's interesting, too, I guess we get an early indication of how well the campaign of the militant godless and other aspects were working. If he says, okay, Christmas and Easter are okay now, and all of a sudden everybody starts celebrating it, it's not necessarily that religion was eradicated. It was probably just pushed out of the churches and into private life during this time.
That's exactly right.
Right.
That's exactly right.
And how did the clergy, I mean, this is one thing that always fascinates me about this, is, you know, how some clergy were still left around during the 1930s. And so you go to the Russian Orthodox Patriarch and say, hey, it's 1941, we got these folks called the Nazis coming in with us. We want you to collaborate with us. I mean, what are the clergy thinking about this? They got to say, oh, Joseph, so, yes, you know, we forgive you for the last 10 years. So, you know, what do we do? It's just, it's incomprehensible how this would play out for me.
Well, you can't envy religious leaders in this country at this particular moment in time. They constantly have to make decisions balancing interests of wanting to exist and to serve those who wish to practice their religion, and yet balance the demands for, if you will, collaboration or at sometimes even cooperation with the state. So they constantly have to tread a very, very, very fine line.
Right.
It's hardest of all for the Russian Orthodox Church, but I think this is a dilemma that all religious groups are going to face.
I can only imagine, too, that, you know, they come with a peace offering and say, okay, we're going to relax restrictions on you. You know, the Russian Orthodox clergy and everybody else saying, okay, yeah, you know, we'll show we can behave and be good, you know, national Russians fighting against the Nazis. And, you know, maybe after the war ends, everything will be okay or better. We'll get some credit for, you know, playing along with the regime during this period of wartime. And one can only imagine, too, I mean, of all the nations that really take the brunt of World War II, Russia is just up there on the top, losing millions and millions and millions of individuals. So, I mean, I would imagine they're fighting for their lives as well.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So there's some relaxation in religious policy during the Second World War. And now this is where I want to bring us up to, because you're very much interested in the borderland region, specifically Ukraine. And as I understand it, parts of Ukraine were part of the Soviet Union prior to World War II, but the bulk of it was independent until 1946, when then it was absorbed within the Soviet Union. Is that correct?
The Soviet Union, during the war, was able to push its westward borders further out.
Okay.
And so it absorbed, during the war, it absorbed territories from a variety of Eastern European countries, which meant that it absorbed all of the functioning religious communities on those territories as well.
And what is the religious landscape of, let's say, Ukraine? Let's take Ukraine specifically, because you've written extensively about that. What did the religious landscape of Ukraine look like in 1944, 1945, relative to the Russian part of the Soviet Union?
Well, Ukraine, the name of the country, Ukraine, by the way, means borderland in and of itself.
Mm.
And it is very much a borderland. And it's important to note that, the western flank, parts of that were part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and then part of a variety of the states that came out of that, Slovakia, Hungary, Romania, and the like. And so it's fairly multi-confessional. There were, prior to the World War II, very significant Jewish communities there, but also a great many Poles, Armenians, and the like. So it's very, very, very multi-ethnic, very multi-confessional. It's also important to note that the western part of Ukraine is really the stronghold of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, which is a Catholic church that practices an Eastern Rite.
Mm, okay.
That is to say, they have married priests,
mm-hmm.
And the liturgy is quite a bit like it is in the Orthodox Church, but they give allegiance to the Pope.
Mm.
So this becomes very significant in that a great many of those communities are brought into the USSR. And Stalin, of course, gets very concerned about the influence of the Pope in that part of the world. I mean, he has plenty of problems with Poland and the
right.
Catholic Church there as it is. And he sees this as being that much closer and that much more problematic once it's now within the territory of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. And we've mentioned how the USSR has been very concerned about the Vatican and the Vatican's role, especially after the post-World War II era. In a previous podcast we had with James Felak, we'll provide a link for those who want to follow this thread of religion within communist societies. But what happens in the Ukraine in 1946? Stalin is concerned. The USSR now includes all of what we consider contemporarily to be the Ukraine. What goes on religious policy-wise here? I mean, they have a much more vibrant religious life circa 1945, 1946. War is over. Things change. What's going on?
It's a very mixed picture in terms of religion. The various freedoms that Stalin granted during the war, by and large, carry on, at least initially. However, in Ukraine, you have really selective repression against certain faith groups. The Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, which I just mentioned, was actually outlawed in 1946, which meant it had approximately 5 million or so believers at that point. It became the largest faith group in the world, status it was to maintain to the conclusion of the Soviet Union, to be actually outright banned from existence. Ukraine was also, it was called the Bible Belt of the Soviet Union because it had the greatest number of Protestant believers.
Mm-hmm.
And coming out of the war, a variety of legislative measures were taken that Baptists and Pentecostals in particular found particularly intrusive. And as a result, a great many Baptists and Pentecostals chose not to register, not to declare their membership, which is not to say that they renounced their faith. They just began to lead an underground clandestine existence.
Mm-hmm.
So although the war and its immediate aftermath ushered forth a lot of religious freedoms, these were not shared across the board with all faith groups.
Okay. And then how does this progress over the next several decades under, Stalin dies in 1953. 1953. Khrushchev comes in, then later Brezhnev. What is the religious policy in the Soviet Union and more specifically Ukraine throughout the post-Stalin era?
We have more paradoxes with the great liberal reformer Khrushchev as part of his de-Stalinization campaign and allowing for somewhat greater civil liberties and a renunciation of the cult of Stalin. Part of this de-Stalinization campaign, however, included rolling back a lot of those freedoms and the relaxation of anti-religious policies that Stalin had put in place. So de-Stalinization for Khrushchev meant limiting the scope and the presence of religion once again. Khrushchev notably declared, you know, we will see the last believer. He made not just the elimination of religion from the public sphere, but the fulfillment of atheism as one of his goals.
Mm-hmm. And how did he go about trying to accomplish this? Was this as repressive as the 1930s campaigns, or was it done in different ways?
He was a little more pragmatic. I mean, I think he understood that the kind of widespread roundups and executions, and this was not going to work. So he tried to rely to a far greater degree on propaganda and agitation. And a lot of work was put forth within schools to try and all children had to study, of course, Marxism-Leninism, but there were courses on atheism. And a lot of effort was made via propaganda in the form of education.
Mm-hmm. And how about the Brezhnev era? Does this continue on? Is there a relaxation?
Well, the Brezhnev era is called the period of stagnation.
Mm-hmm.
And there, Brezhnev, once again, takes things to a more pragmatic level. Under Khrushchev, the political costs and the discrediting of the regime in terms of the enormous efforts and that were expended to round up and persecute believers, ultimately it was viewed that was ineffective. This is
right.
Not helpful. This alienates more people, and it's just not really advancing the cause of the economic and social development of the country. So under Brezhnev, you have a far more pragmatic sort of an understanding that there's going to be a cohabitation, if you will. And there's more of an effort to make clear what the parameters of acceptable forms of public presence and public activities for religious organizations, what those are.
What would some of those parameters be? If I was a Baptist and living in 1975 in Russia, what would my parameter be? What could I do and what could I not do?
Well, for example, these are some of the things that were most troubling to various Protestant groups such as Baptists. There were enormous restrictions on education, sort of Sunday school programs, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
There could be no formal education for children.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not to say that it didn't happen, but it happened very informally and very much on a clandestine level.
Right.
There was even a period when, under Khrushchev, when children were not even supposed to be in services.
Okay.
And there were technically was there could the possibility existed that inspectors could be there checking to verify that no children were in the church during a service.
And that's interesting. I mean, it fits a lot with what we know about the sociology of religion and socialization. That if you send your kid to Sunday school and have him educated in the faith, well, he'll probably grow up in that faith as well. But on the flip side is if you keep him away from religious education, by the time they're 18 or 19, they're not going to run off and join a church,
right,
per se. Right.
And that, by and large, was the case. I think mm-hmm. that pattern, that was a reasonable gamble, and it did really pan out, by and large, in the Soviet Union.
So we see a generational fading of religiosity, religious practice within the Soviet Union, within Ukraine during this time.
Yes, it is progressive, and then subsequent generations know actually less and less
mm-hmm.
about religion in terms of the various traditions, symbolism, holidays, as well as, you know, theological aspects.
Mm-hmm.
There is really a forgetting, a withering, if you will, of that knowledge.
Okay. And what do you think, you know, to what extent do we know today, was there these traditions passed on in the home, or did this wither away too?
I think to a stunning degree, it also withered away.
Mm-hmm.
Certain things were passed along, but very often in a very abbreviated or truncated form. When you asked that, I was reminded of the time I was with in a Jewish family in Moscow, and they wished to, quote-unquote, celebrate Yom Kippur. This was in the 90s, and so they served sausage on matzo, and everybody had small glasses of vodka to, quote-unquote, celebrate Yom Kippur. I mean, they were trying to be good Jews, but if you don't know what their traditions are and what the significance of this particular moment is and how one is supposed to commemorate it as opposed to celebrate it.
One can fully understand this too as a parent, and you have enough stuff to do with work and taking care of the household and that, and that's why you send kids to Sunday school. It's a more efficient way of getting them educated in religious faith. And if you have to do it at home, it gets tough and it gets bypassed. Then, as you say, it withers, it fades away.
And of course, if nobody told you anything, then what do you have to pass on? And I think over time there was really an ignorance, if you will. And mm-hmm. I don't mean that in a judgmental way. It wasn't their fault. How could they? There was so few avenues to learn that kind of information. Sort of a certain kind of ignorance, and out of that came indifference.
Right.
That set in over time.
I think this fits a lot with what Yana Coney has talked about in terms of religious capital. Is that if you practice it a lot, you know it more. If you don't practice it a lot, you know it less, and
that's
it fades.
Right.
So it's interesting that the most fierce campaigns of repression might not have necessarily done the most damage to religion, but just the slow neglect over time and the inability of people being able to meet had its impact.
But it's important to note, though, that means that in the Soviet Union, although they were trying to create atheism and trying to build convictions of atheism in their people, they felt they came quite short there. But what they did achieve, and this is notable in and of itself, is this kind of ignorance of religion, and then as a result, that expresses itself in terms of indifference.
Mm-hmm. And that's interesting, and that I occurs throughout this generational withering or generational fade occurs throughout the 1970s. You had Andropov and Chernenkov, whatever they did. Okay, they didn't last too long. Gorbachev, what happens during the Gorbachev era? Is there any kind of relaxation as well? Any changes?
Well, there's the momentous event, the millennial commemoration of the Christianization of Kiev and Rus, or of this the seen as sort of the proto Slavic state. That is to say, they recognize that 1,000 years ago they accepted Christianity,
right?
And so it becomes sort of a black paradox. This is a tradition that carried on for 1,000 years, and they're commemorating it, even though over the past 74 years they've expended enormous energies in undermining it, and yet it is commemorated, and it's commemorated with enormous fanfare. And this is part of Gorbachev's effort to try and once again restructure, as he called it, the society via encouraging openness or glasnost.
Mm-hmm. And this was in 1988, correct?
1988.
And so we're, now with 2020 hindsight, 1988 is definitely the waning years of the Soviet Union. 1989, Berlin Wall falls, Eastern Europe collapses like a series of dominoes. The Baltic states start clamoring for independence. The borderland states of Ukraine saying, hey, we won in this game too. 1991, Soviet Union, game over. So let's, with the time that we have remaining here, really talk about what is the religious landscape in the post-1991 era and the post-Soviet era, the last two decades that we're talking about here. Religion has faded. All of a sudden now we get the new change. Yeltsin comes in. You get the independent states, the Commonwealth of Independent States. What does the religious landscape look like in the 1990s in Russia and in the Ukraine?
Well, you start having enormous differences that begin taking root. The successor states, the 15 successor states to the Soviet Union, all face specific challenges. And looking in particular at Russia and Ukraine, comparing those two, you have Ukraine that's never before in its history had an internationally recognized independent state. Although there have been attempts over the course of its history to achieve independence, all of those attempts never came to fruition. So this is a big moment. And so right away, the Orthodox model is such that, you have a Bulgarian Orthodox Church, Greek Orthodox, etc. It follows a nation-state model.
National churches, right.
Right. And so, of course, then moves begin in Ukraine to form then a Ukrainian Orthodox Church. This is a radical idea in that if you look throughout Russia and Ukraine, the there are more Orthodox churches in Ukraine than there are in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And there was far higher levels of religious practice and religious allegiance to the church, because the church there always had other kind of political connotations that were ones based on resistance, if
right.
you will.
Much like in Poland or
That's
Lithuania.
Right.
Right.
That's right, which you don't so much have in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
So the church had far more credibility in Ukraine and still does today, although I would add that the church, both in Russia and Ukraine today, are among the most trusted institutions, but it's far more trusted in Ukraine than it is in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. with attempts to create then an independent Ukrainian Orthodox Church, those were then, of course, thwarted by the Russian Orthodox Church that, of course, does not
right.
would not like to see this occur.
Well, what about the Greek Catholic Church? I mean, was this... I mean, it seems, as you mentioned before, that the Greek Catholic Church is straddling both worlds of Orthodoxy and Roman Catholicism to some extent. They borrow from both traditions, show allegiance to the Pope. Did the Greek Catholic Church say, oh, yeah, we want to be Ukrainian Orthodox now? Did they keep their own church? What happened there?
Initially, there were many – when the church was outlawed and a lot of their properties were given over to the Orthodox Church. And so there were some tens years there in resorting out properties, what belonged to whom and what should be returned and what should not. But that has all passed, and I think the Greek, the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church is now quite robust and up and running, and thriving at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to note that church, of course, could make appeals to the greater Catholic Church for support.
Right.
And there was, especially among the Ukrainian diaspora, which, you know, there were enormous numbers of Ukrainian refugees that left Ukraine during the war and settled in Canada and in the United States. And
mm-hmm.
they then were able to help in terms of with clergy and finances and the like. So that church really rebounded quite well and rather quickly.
So how does – you talk about the rebounding in the 1991s. Is there an uptick in religious practice and religious interest? And and you could compare this in Russia and Ukraine, I guess. What is it looking like? Is it secularization theory, right, everybody, 1991, nobody's going to church anymore? Or is there a rebound of religion?
Well, in the early in the 1990s, of course, there was just the newness and the curiosity factor.
Right.
So you had enormous numbers of people showing up in church to see what it looked like. What
mm-hmm.
does one do here? What's this all about? There was really something of a religious renaissance, in part driven by, I think, just sheer curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
This was a place you couldn't go to before, and now you can.
Did it have anything to do with the fact that a number of missionaries were starting to flood into the country now?
There were huge numbers of missionaries, especially from the United States, that arrived in Ukraine from a whole variety of faith groups because they saw this as a region of the world that had been denied access to religion and religious knowledge and the like, and they sought to respond to that. And this did have an effect. I mean, Protestant faiths are quite strong in Ukraine, given that there's approximately 2 million or so Protestants in Ukraine, which is a high number, given that U.S. refugee policy was such that those that were persecuted for their religious beliefs were allowed to immigrate out. And huge numbers of Protestants did immigrate out. So those that are Protestant in Ukraine today, by and large, are recent converts.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I think on one level that had more of a help in terms of actually building church buildings and building the infrastructure necessary. You have to keep in mind that right at the moment, and this was of course very painful for the Orthodox Church, right at the moment when the interest was highest, the church was in at least able to respond to it. There was way too many clergy, way too few clergy, way too few church buildings, very little means of religious instruction, and way too few Bibles and hymnals and anything else that one needed.
You know, in Russia, they've been attenuated, as you mentioned, for 74 years. In the Ukraine, you know, for less period of time since, you know, the 1940s. And so they're at a disadvantage. On top of that, the Russian Orthodox Church, much like Catholicism, is very priest-centric, whereas, you know, you have the incoming missionaries, they're much more nimble, they don't need as many fancy cathedrals, the, you know, Pentecostals especially, hey, we'll set up, you know, give us a warehouse, and we're good to go, and, you know, we'll have somebody from the, you know, parishioner base mentor really quickly, and you're up and running. So I could see where the Russian Orthodox Church was at a huge disadvantage.
That's right. I mean, they have, you know, icons and iconostasis, and yes, I mean, in the choir, and there's a whole variety of trappings that are part of the liturgy, which is what makes it beautiful, but also what made it a very easy target under these repressive policies.
Mm-hmm. And how did the Roman Orthodox Church respond to this, you know, growing interest in Protestantism and the curiosity of new religions and such?
Initially, the Orthodox Church responded quite negatively. They felt that these groups were coming in from abroad, and they were bringing in resources and, if you will, buying believers.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of religious groups, of course, also began distributing humanitarian aid, which was much, much needed in the early 1990s. Mm-hmm. But that was seen as yet again another unfair advantage, if you will. There was an attempt for example, in Russian schools, to set up a course on ethics, and it was meant to be fairly ecumenical in character, but it didn't take long before the charges were made that this was really a covert attempt to proselytize, because it was a curriculum that was largely written in the West and seen as written from a Protestant perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So that effort evaporated, but there were some attempts to cooperate and collaborate and respond to this tremendous outpouring of interest. There was a widespread view on the part of the Orthodox that it was a very, very uneven playing field,
mm-hmm.
and that foreigners had a great deal of advantages that the Orthodox Church, be it the Russian Orthodox Church or the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, which then they carve out their own Ukrainian Orthodox Church, and they have their own patriarch at this point, but it's not a patriarch that's recognized in Constantinople. But there is now a Ukrainian Orthodox Church with a patriarch in Kiev.
Mm-hmm.
There's the Russian Orthodox Church in Ukraine, which goes by Ukrainian Orthodox Church Moscow Patriarch,
mm-hmm.
and then there is the Ukrainian Autocephalous Orthodox Church that thrived in the diaspora that now has returned. So there are three competing Orthodox churches in Ukraine.
Wow, that's interesting. Any effort to reunite those? I can imagine the institutional politics that kind of goes on there.
There are tremendous efforts, particularly the outgoing President Yushchenko tried at the highest levels to try and unite the three. Those efforts have obviously been unsuccessful, not just because of the different historical and political orientations between the three churches, but as I mentioned, I mean, there's resistance to that within the Russian Orthodox Church. But some have argued, and I would say that this is most of the other faith groups in Ukraine find it to their advantage,
mm-hmm.
that there is a splintered Orthodox Church and not a single Orthodox Church that has the weight and the political power that it does in Russia.
And so there's probably a different... So in Russia, the Russian Orthodox Church, being more unified, has a lot more weight. Now, I know through my own research that it was 1997 a law was passed in Russia, basically making the Russian Orthodox Church, as well as a few other confessions, the Judaism, Islam, and Buddhism, as the official churches, which gave them significant advantages over less than official churches.
Right. Traditional was the word they used. There were four faiths that were recognized as being traditional, that is to say historically indigenous to the region.
Mm-hmm.
And all others that were not went into this second tier category.
And how has that law affected in within Russia affected the religious landscape? Has it made it a lot more difficult for Protestants, your Baptists, your Pentecostals, your Mormons, whoever? Has that made it more difficult for them or not?
Yes, definitely. It's more difficult to register a religious group. It's more cumbersome. They can't distribute humanitarian aid directly. They have to do it via a state organization. It's much more difficult.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, in terms of, let's go back, and we got off on a sidetrack. I want to come back to what the religious landscape looks like, both in Russia and Ukraine. You had mentioned, you know, in the early to mid-1990s, this curiosity effect, and people are coming in the churches, oh, there's these interesting missionaries, or there's this thing called the Orthodox Church that was always there, and let's peek in the doors and see what's going on there. Has that continued on? Has religious practice increased in both Ukraine and Russia? Has it plateaued? Has it declined? What is going on right now, say, in the last 10 years in the religious landscape in Ukraine and Russia?
Well, let's take Ukraine first. I would say sort of the Renaissance has waned. I mean, in other words, it's not a new phenomenon anymore. Having said that, I do think it has stabilized, and you do nonetheless consistently, year after year, see a growth in the number of religious communities that register, and there is an ever-widening spectrum of faith groups that exist in Ukraine. So although I would say the Renaissance per se is that followed in the 1990s is over, I do see the situation stabilizing and stabilizing in a pattern of slow but nonetheless steady growth. In Russia, I would say it's the Renaissance is also over, but and the growth has been has fallen off to a more notable extent. Which is, in a sense, I would say that there's still, an allegiance to Orthodoxy. It's a very kind of paradoxical situation in Russia. There's a growing recognition of the contribution that the Orthodox Church has made to Russian culture and Russian history over the year, and the important contribution it has made and can continue to make in terms of fostering the moral development and a sense of ethics within the society. But you don't have the same degree of participation and the same levels of participation in Russia that you do find in Ukraine.
Now, this is my hypothesis that I've worked on for a while. If I had to compare these two, and so you're saying, okay, you see a plateauing of religious growth in the Ukraine, although it's creeping up slowly, greater pluralism occurring. In Russia, it plateaus, but it kind of stagnates and might even be declining a little bit. To what extent do you think the difference between those two nations is really effect of that 1997 law in Russia as compared to other factors? Well, I mean, what things might be affecting the Russian religious landscape that's not affecting the Ukrainian religious landscape?
I think not so much the law, but rather the privileged status that Orthodoxy has. This is at once a blessing and a curse. It's a curse to the extent that I think there's a widespread view that the church does exist and that the state has and probably will, to a degree, continue to provide for it. And so there's not a sense of an individual obligation to support the church. It is a very, very large, even monolithic institution, and that's where it, in part, what gets it its power. But in the same breath, that too is quite a mixed blessing, to the extent that it's an open and easy target for criticism. It's a single institution, and you either support it or you don't. In a place like Ukraine, where you have several competing Orthodox churches, they distinguish themselves by the various positions that they've taken over time and the various connections that they offer, be it to Russia, be it to the Ukrainian state itself, or be it to the history of exile and refugees and the Ukrainian diaspora living abroad. And each of those churches then is more so its own political voice. It offers its own commentary on issues in contemporary Ukraine.
And each of those Russian, or I shouldn't say Russian, each of those Orthodox churches in Ukraine is really autonomous from the state. There's not one that's more favored by the government than the other, or this equal playing field for them?
Well, it depends. Gosh, we just had a change of governments there.
Right.
And so arguably Yushchenko clearly wanted, that's the outgoing president, wanted a Ukrainian Orthodox church.
Just one,
yeah. And Ukrainian. So in other words, not the Russian Orthodox Church, even though, as I mentioned, in Ukraine, it goes by the name the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, Moscow Patriarchate.
Right.
He was less inclined towards that church. Yanukovych, the new incoming president, is far more open to fostering those connections with Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that will translate into a restoration of a more privileged status for the Ukrainian Orthodox Church Moscow Patriarchate or not remains to be seen.
Right.
I think there's a certain guarded optimism at this point that at least doesn't mean that there will be any kind of discrimination towards other faith groups.
Mm-hmm. So this kind of wraps us around, and we're coming to the end of our podcast here, but it wraps us around again to the title of your talk that you're giving today, The Future of Disbelief. And, you know, here's your time now to speculate about what the future of religion is. And I know historians don't like to think about the future too much, more about the past, but, you know, here's your chance. What does the next 10 years look like in terms of Ukraine, in terms of Russia? Where is the religious environment moving in the next 10 years?
I think in the case of Ukraine, there's certainly an acceptance of religious institutions and an acceptance of the various positive functions they can fulfill in society. And I see continued religious participation there in this kind of slow and steady chiseling away at this legacy of ignorance and indifference that has been bequeathed to the region based on 74 years of socialism. In the case of Russia, I think it's harder to predict in that it's very much of a hybrid kind of sense of religious identity. That core of disbelief, if you will, I think is there. But it's complemented by an acknowledgement of the benefits of the Orthodox Church, which in an ironic paradox very often doesn't include religion. In mm-hmm. other words, there's widespread recognition of its contribution to arts and to knowledge and the architecture, whole variety of spheres of social life.
It's part of the Russian national identity.
That's exactly right. And so for that reason, it has meaning and it has allegiance.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not so much meaning and allegiance that's focused on religion. Having said that, without a crystal ball, I don't know politically what's going to happen. But because there is that meaning and allegiance that's there, that could at any moment be, I think, activated or expanded. Or in other words, I don't think just because there isn't active levels of religious participation that one can conclude that the church isn't a player politically or that we don't need to study religion in that part of the world.
Right.
I think the Orthodox Church remains important, but it's of interest, I think, to people who study religion in that it is this very kind of a hybrid kind of identity that has developed there. It's a religious-based identity that very often doesn't include religion.
Mm-hmm.
People very often in the same breath identify as Orthodox and non-believer.
Right.
And see no paradox, no contradiction there at all, no paradox
right.
whatsoever.
It does become an ethnic identity, and I know that Putin has, during his time as president and now as prime minister, has really tried to resurrect that Russian nationalist sense of things, and the Russian Orthodox Church, I guess, would be, an important aspect of it, even devoid of religion.
Right.
Yeah.
But recognizing the other domains in which it has made a significant contribution and does and should matter to individuals.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be interesting to watch what the landscape is here over the next 10 years. Again, it's been an interesting test case of secularization theory that even frontal assaults of against religion, either as an institution or a belief system, are not altogether effective. They've had their ability to reduce it, as we say, through a generational fading away of religiosity. But, you know, once the environment changes a little bit, we see a renaissance and a resurrection of religious growth. And what that means in the future, we'll have to find out. And maybe we'll have you back again in a year or two to figure out where the landscape has been going here in Russia. So I want to thank Catherine Wanner for, again, being on Research on Religion.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.